It's time now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Today's message was preached during a Sunday morning worship service held on the university campus. Following the reading of the scripture from Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, our speaker will be Dr. Royce Short, Dean of the School of Religion at BJU.
Just before the message, which will be preached by Dr. Royce Short, the Dean of the School of Religion, we want to turn our Bibles this morning to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. As we prepare for the message, we'll read the first six verses of Ecclesiastes 7. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. God bless the reading and the preaching of his word this morning to our hearts.
Perhaps as the text was being read to you this morning, you wondered, well, I wonder which phrase he's going to pick out of such a strange text and use that as a springboard and jump to another portion of the Bible. And then we will use that other portion of the Bible as our passage to study this morning. Well, this is the text, okay? This is not a springboard for another text. This is our text, and in fact, we're going to use the words of chapter 7, the first words of verse 2, as our theme. As it says here, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Or let's put it in our vernacular for today. Our theme is going to be, it is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. It is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. Now, such words seem to go all against our best judgment. And I'm sure for many of you, you're probably thinking, wait a minute, Royce, why in the world do you use such a text as this? And why in the world would you use a text like that when you're speaking to a crowd that is predominantly made up of young people who are 25 years of age and younger? I mean, if you want to preach this, go to a nursing home or somewhere, but don't preach this to a young college crowd. Well, let me give you a little background so you understand why we're going to be looking at this text this morning. On a Tuesday afternoon, many of you were seated with me over in Rhoda Haver Auditorium for a funeral. Some of you, 9 days after that, on Thursday, were again seated in Rhoda Haver Auditorium for another funeral. And you know, as I was sitting there that day, young people, I thought to myself, wow, last week I was sitting in this building attending a funeral. Today I'm sitting in this building attending a funeral. And through my mind ran the thought, I wonder a week from today if I'm going to be sitting in this building attending another funeral. Well, sure enough, 9 days later, a Saturday, I was seated not in Rhoda Haver Auditorium, but I was seated at Mount Calvary Baptist Church. And in each of those services, as I sat there with tears in my eyes, a lump in my throat, and yet great joy, knowing that each of these had been faithful in the call to which God had given to them, and each one was at that very moment in the presence of the Lord. As I sat there, three different people from three different careers dying at three different times in life, I asked myself the question, what can I learn from this? What can I do as I attend a funeral that will make me a better person as a result of having been here? Now, perhaps you wonder and you say, wait a minute, but why in the world ponder a funeral? I mean, don't we just go to funerals out of respect for the family and then as soon as it's over, we want to get out of there and get our minds on more pleasant thoughts? Well, you need to remember that I was raised in a funeral home, for my father is a funeral director. And therefore, I grew up seeing an awful lot of death. I saw a lot of young people die, and I saw a lot of old people die. I saw men die, and I saw women die. I saw people die naturally, as we would say, and I saw people who had died accidentally. But as I grew up for all of those 18 years at home, I was constantly confronted with death and, shall we say, trying to learn lessons from it. And so as I sat in the funerals those days and pondered the message, the Lord impressed upon my heart and he said, Roy, sometime when you preach here at Bob Jones University, you've got to preach this message. You've got to preach on this particular theme to that young audience because there's some very important things that they need to hear. But you say again, wait a minute, you know, the audience is predominantly less than 25 years old. What in the world can someone so young, so full of life and vigor, ever learn from going to a funeral? Why is it so important for someone at that age to stop and think and ask some questions about life? Well, let's put it this way. You don't know how to live until you're ready to die. Okay, young people, you don't know how to live until you're ready to die. Or let's maybe phrase it a little bit differently. You don't know what is valuable in life until you have measured it in light of death. You have no idea what's valuable in life at 25 years old until you've measured it against your death. Or let's maybe state it another way. You don't know what is important in the present unless you look at the present against the backdrop of eternity. In other words, you have absolutely no idea to make proper value judgments right now in time as a 22-year-old unless you can see what is in front of your eyes against the backdrop of eternity and what really matters. The more I study the Bible and the older I grow, both physically and spiritually, the more I realize that some of the great personages in the Bible, the reason that they were able to, as we might say, overcome great obstacles or odds, and the reason that their lives were so marvelously used of God, was simply because they had looked to death in the face and they had looked down the corridors of time into eternity, and they had learned to see everything that was in front of them in time against the backdrop of eternity. Think for me, for just a moment, if you will, of the example of Abraham. His life is spread out over so many chapters in the first book of the Bible, in the book of Genesis. And we think of the radical decisions he made. And I realize there were times when he failed. His life was kind of like a yo-yo. And yet think of those great times of faith when he stepped out against all odds and made unbelievably great decisions, simply trusting God. And then we come to the book of Hebrews, and I think we're given a great insight in just one sentence, in just one phrase, into why he was able to do it. For as it says in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 10, he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. In other words, he was able to look down the corridors of time and all the contemporary glitz and everything that was put in front of him at the moment only meant something in light of what he sought against the backdrop of eternity. And that's why he was able to step out on faith and do those things that he did. You keep reading the Bible, you come to another famous personage named Moses. And of course, many of the chapters in the Pentateuch are revolve around his life. And again, you think of Moses' life and some of the decisions that he made that were very, very radical. And you say, how in the world could he do that? Once again, I think Hebrews 11, the great faith chapter, has encapsulated that in a very small measure. In a couple of verses, chapter 11, verses 24, 25, 26, thereabouts, when it tells us how, once again, Moses refused to look at all the glitz of Egypt. He refused to look at all those tempting things that were put in front of him in time, because he could look down the corridors of time and he could see it all against the backdrop of eternity. And he was able to say no to all that royal training he had and to be refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He could look at all those other opportunities he had and say, no, I'm willing to side with the people of God and take a stand that will cost me. But he did it because he saw everything in time, and he was able to make all of his decisions in time because he saw it against the backdrop of eternity. Well, you think of the great Apostle Paul, and for many, many years earlier in my life in ministry, I used to, should we say, scratch my head and say, how in the world can the Apostle Paul, or how could the Apostle Paul go through everything he went through in life and ministry and still always seem to have a smile on his face and see the hand of God in it and always be prospering and always be so joyful? And then the more I studied him and the more I personally walk with God, I began to realize, especially as he tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, a chapter where he lists a lot of his ministry hardships. But he says twice in that section, he says, I'm not about to give up. I'm not about to throw in the towel. And he tells us why. He reminds us it's because he had learned to see everything in time against the backdrop of eternity. He had looked death in the face. He had looked the next life in the face. And because of that, he knew what was important, and he was willing to give his life for it. And therefore, with every decision he made in time, he realized it was the right decision because it was a decision that would stand up against the backdrop of eternity. I know that you young people are constantly bombarded with an opposite philosophy or an opposite worldview today, which basically says, grab all the gusto you can right now. It's all so glitzy. It's all so contemporary. It's all so great. You've got to get hold of it now. And in reality, all of the advertising and all of these things that are bombarding you every day and trying to get your attention are really nothing other than, should we say, an outplay of what the Humanist Manifesto 2 of 1973 states very succinctly when it says, "Promises of immortal salvation or fear of eternal damnation are both illusory and harmful. They distract humans from present concerns, from self-actualization, and from rectifying social justices." You see what's at the basis of our philosophy, our worldview, our culture of today? They say you don't have a right to think about the good things that might happen in the next life, or that there might be such thing as a bad next life, because that's all just illusory. That's not real anyhow. That's harmful for you to think of anything beyond this life. Because they said what you need to do is you need to really throw yourself into this life so you can do some rectifying of so-called social injustices and everything else. Well, young people don't believe such a lie from the pit of hell, because that's all it is. If all you can see is what's in front of you, if all you can see are the blinking lights that are flashing and trying to draw your attention now, I pity you, because you're going to waste this life, and I pity you to think of where you might be for the next life. C.S. Lewis, in just one phrase, has well encapsulated the error of this humanist position as well as a good biblical position. For C.S. Lewis said, "Aim at heaven and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you will get neither." And when you study or read his quote in context, he simply is talking about the exact opposite of what the Humanist Manifesto 2 says, because he reminds us that those Christians who have done the most for this present life are actually those Christians who had their goal set on the next life. And it's because they could look down the corridors of time and eternity that told them what was important in this life and how they should invest their life now. And that's why they made such an impact on contemporary society, because they didn't look at contemporary society. They looked at eternity. They looked death square in the face. And that told them what was important, what they should be doing right now. And young people, that's why we come to this text this morning. And I've said all this is simply an introduction for us to set the stage so you understand why it is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. Now, as we come to our text, chapter 7 of the book of Ecclesiastes, there is great debate concerning the outline of these verses, concerning the cohesiveness and so on of them. And we're not going to get in a big discussion over that. I'm going to simply take the first 7 verses as being a unit, however, and all of these verses supposedly revolving around that phrase in verse 2. It is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. Perhaps this brief paragraph at the beginning of chapter 7 is actually an answer to the question that chapter 6 ends with, where it says, "For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life which he spends as a shadow." And so we're going to try and unwrap this text, and we're going to try and look at what this text tells us as it seems to answer this question in telling us why it is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. Before we look at approximately 8 lessons, let me just call time out here and make this statement so you get a proper perspective. Neither this text here in Ecclesiastes 7, nor the book of Ecclesiastes as a whole, nor the Bible, none of those things tell us that there's something inherently wrong with parties. So if you say, "Wow, Royce, are you telling me that I can never have a celebration? I can never go to another party, or I'm unspiritual, maybe I'm even non-Christian? Is that what you're saying?" Absolutely not. We're not saying that at all, for the Bible tells us, this very book, Ecclesiastes, tells us, we are supposed to joy and rejoice and take full advantage of all the good gifts that God has given to us. In fact, I love a billboard that used to be out in Salt Lake City when we lived there for so many years. I loved to pass the billboard because it said what I wanted to hear. It said, "Life is short, eat dessert first." And that's exactly right. There's nothing wrong with eating dessert first, and nothing wrong with enjoying life and all of God's gifts. So keep that in the back of your mind when we say it's better to go to a funeral than to a party. We're not saying parties are wrong, okay? But the writer is reminding us of a very important thing that he's going to make. And we're going to see that we surely do learn an awful lot more when we attend a funeral than when we attend a party. So lesson number 1 that we want to notice is just continuing right after that phrase in the second verse of Ecclesiastes chapter 7. It is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party, for that is the end of all men. And that is simply meaning for death or for a funeral is the end of everybody. So therefore, lesson number one that we can learn from going to a funeral is that death is the destiny of every person. Lesson number one, death is the destiny of every person. I know when a person is young and strong and beautiful, he or she likes to view himself as being invincible. And you like to look down the road maybe and say, well, I have another 40, 50, 60 years to live. So why should I even think about dying now? That's the time of life when you look out and you say, well, I have the world by a tail. I control everything that is going on. And yet, when you're attending a party with other people who are strong and healthy and good looking, you can seem to very easily forget the frailty of your own human constitution, and that you could literally be just a matter of seconds from meeting your Maker face to face. And so when a person goes to a funeral, it can be a very valuable time because it reminds him of his own mortality, whether they be few days or whether they be many days. It reminds him indeed that one day, and probably one day sooner than he would like to think, he's going to have to answer the door, and death is going to be what is knocking at his door. As Solomon tells us here in Ecclesiastes, it doesn't matter if you're male or female. It doesn't matter if you're wise or unwise. It doesn't matter if you are rich or poor. It doesn't matter what your social standing is. He says, death is the great equalizer. And so, as we could easily say, every funeral simply anticipates my own. Every funeral I attend is simply an anticipation that someday I, too, Roy Short, am going to die. Supposedly it is said of Philip of Macedon, who, as you know, is the father of Alexander the Great. It's supposedly said of him that Philip had a servant, and he told that servant that every day he wanted that servant to come to him every morning and say, Philip, remember that you must die. Because even he, in his royal position, wanted to constantly have before him a reminder that he was mortal and that he, too, would die someday. So that's lesson number one. Death is the destiny of every person. And then lesson number two, we can learn it is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party, because a funeral puts me in a serious frame of mind to stop and think. A funeral puts me in a serious frame of mind to stop and think. We seem to see this in verses 3-6, as well as the last part of verse 1. As it talks about here, going to parties and so on like that, parties, of course, are characterized by a lot of eating and drinking and feasting and laughter and frivolity. And remember what I just said, there's nothing inherently sinful with any of those things. It's just, however, when we go to parties, we generally don't say, I'm going to a party because I need some intellectual stimulation. No, we go there because we want to unwind. We go there because we want to be entertained. We go there because we don't want to think. And so, as it tells us here in verse 5, where it talks about it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools, it simply seems to be a reminder to us that when we're at a party, we don't expect people to correct us or rebuke us so that we can learn lessons, because you don't go to a party to have somebody put your life under a microscope and tell you areas of your life that need to be challenged. Likewise, in verse 6, it describes all this levity as being like the crackling of thorns under a pot. And the point that is being made here is when those thorns are simply lit, they burn very quickly, they make a lot of noise while they're burning, but in reality they really don't accomplish very much, they're just very short-lived. And the writer here, Solomon, simply says that's the way it is when you go to a party. There's a lot of noise, a lot of crackling, a lot of popping, a lot of fireworks, if you will, going on, but it's all very short-lived, and when it's all done, it really didn't accomplish very much, it really didn't produce very much. And therefore, that's why he says it's better to go to a funeral, because it puts you in a serious frame of mind to stop and think about some areas you need to be challenged in. Likewise, the very last part of verse 1, where he says the day of death is better than the day of one's birth, which once again strikes us very strange. But probably the point that he's making here is, again, he's not saying there's something wrong with celebrating at a time of birth, because when a child is born, that's a time for great celebration and joy. But again, it's generally not a time when people sit down and think seriously about a lot of things, because they're really just, you know, kind of dreaming the future. I wonder what this young man's going to do with his life. I wonder where this young lady's going to spend her life. But it's at a funeral instead, when a person sits and has the luxury of looking back and saying, look what this person did. Look at their strengths and look at their weaknesses. There's something here for us to learn. And so, as the writer reminds us here, when we're at a funeral, our minds are directed towards sober realities. And so, as we just noticed in verse 5, we're open to hearing rebuke of the wise people. That is, when someone rebukes us, hopefully we're open to being corrected. We're open to learning lessons. And he's saying, so it is when you go to a funeral. It causes you to stop and think and take some stock about things. And as a result, you're open and you're willing to make some changes. And thus, we could summarize this second lesson by simply saying a funeral is much better than a party, because a funeral can make us a wiser individual. Lesson number 3 we can learn by looking at the very first phrase in chapter 7 and verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment. And again, this verse can be interpreted many ways and so on. I'm taking it in one of the possible interpretations as I'm taking it to tie into our overall theme phrase here. And so we'll say that lesson number 3 is simply a funeral is better than a party, because we can learn the value of the internal over the external. A funeral is better than a party because we learn the value of the internal over the external. You say, what does that mean? Well, when he talks here about a good name, you need to remember that in their society, a name was not just a vocable that somebody would answer to when somebody spoke those words or when somebody spoke that name. But rather, a name was meant to indicate somewhat of an individual's character, what hopefully the parents would see in that young man or that young lady as they grew up. And so what Solomon is reminding us of here, he's saying that your name, that's what you really are, your character, the stuffing out of which you're made, he says, is far more valuable to you than just a precious ointment or things which are external. And of course, you might stop and think of it like this. When a person goes to a funeral, you usually don't hear people talking or giving eulogies that deal with the externals. In other words, you probably don't hear somebody say, well, I'm glad I was so-and-so's friend because he drove such a nifty sports car. No. Or you probably don't have some young lady get up and say, I sure am glad that I knew this lady who just passed away, because she always dressed in the latest wardrobes, had the snazziest fashions. No, that's generally not what you hear when you attend a funeral and eulogies are given. But rather, people get up and they talk about the character of that individual. And they say, I thank God that I could be a friend of this man or this woman, because their character was sterling. They taught me something. They made me a better person. They sharpened me. And that's what Solomon reminds us of right here. It's far better to go to a funeral where you begin to realize that all the external stuff, all those things that we like to accumulate around us, can only mock us in the end. But what's really remembered about somebody is, what were they really like? Lesson number 4 we find in chapter 2, the third part of that verse. It's better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. And the very last phrase of verse 2, the living will lay it to his heart. And so we will simply say here that our lesson number 4 is, it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a party, because there are so many lessons to learn. There are so many lessons to learn at a funeral. That is, as I contemplate the reality of death, all of a sudden, I can have my life opened so that I can learn how to live the fullest life possible right now. As Moses would say in Psalm chapter 90 and verse 12, so teach us to number our days that we might apply our hearts unto wisdom. And all through those years of being a pastor, there wasn't a funeral that I conducted as I stood at the cemetery and I stood there and I contemplated and I thought, and as I prayed just before that body would be lowered in the ground, and I would say, oh God, we're reiterating the words of Moses who said, teach us to number our days so that we can be a wiser person, because we're still alive and we have some days to live. And that's exactly what Solomon is telling us right here. He's saying, when you go to a funeral, you begin to be a wiser person, because it causes you to reflect on your own life, saying, am I spending my days in a way that is most appropriate? And now what I'd like to do for the last 4 lessons to learn, I'd like us to jump outside of chapter 7, because as he tells us right here, there are so many other lessons we can lay to heart. And so I would like to jump outside of chapter 7 and just go to other places in the book of Ecclesiastes and see what some of these other lessons are that he talks about in other passages, since he talks so much about death in this book. Lesson number 5 we find in a passage like chapter 7 and verse 17, or chapter 8 and verse 8, or chapter 9 verses 12 and 13. And this is how we will summarize it. Lesson number 5, it is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party, because although I can't avoid death, it is best or it is wise not to act foolishly and to hasten my death. Okay, that's lesson number 5. Even though I cannot avoid death, for we just said it, lesson number 1 was that everybody's going to die. Solomon also tells us, don't be a fool and go out there and hasten your death by doing dumb things. Okay, now what does that mean? Well, think of it like this. Have you ever attended the funeral of someone who passed away because of lung cancer, and that lung cancer was actually brought on because of a bad habit they had of smoking cigarettes or cigars? Well, maybe you were at a funeral like that, and of course, as you walked away, since I don't smoke, I can say, well, thankfully I don't smoke, so hopefully that means I'm not going to die of lung cancer, although it doesn't mean that I might not die of lung cancer, although it wouldn't be attributed to smoking. But I can hopefully walk away from that funeral and think of other things and say, oh God, is there something in my life that I am doing that's literally destroying my body and hastening my death? Have you ever been at a funeral home viewing, or have you ever been at a funeral and seen people standing outside the funeral home or standing outside the church building? And there they are, puffing away on cigarettes, just smoking up a storm. And they'll tell you, well, I'm just so tense over this whole situation, having lost this friend of mine, I've got to relax a little bit. And you just shake your head and say, that is really dumb, isn't it? Because here they are, they've come to the funeral of somebody who died of lung cancer from smoking too much, and now they say, in order to relax while I try and forget about his death, I'm hastening my own death by standing here and smoking. Well, that's what we're talking about when we say that a funeral can be an opportunity for us to learn this all-important lesson of simply laying it to heart and saying, hey, am I doing something that will hasten my death and bring it on prematurely? Lesson number 6 we can find in chapter 5, verses 15 to 16, where he says, as I came forth of my mother's womb, naked will I return, and so forth. And so our lesson number 6 will state like this: a funeral can also teach me that if I live only for this life, it is all meaningless. A funeral can also teach me that if I live only for this life, it is all meaningless. For as Solomon says, I came into this world empty-handed, and when I leave this world, I'm going to leave it empty-handed. I've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul as it goes to the cemetery following a funeral. And that's simply because when a person dies, you don't take anything with you. You came into this world empty-handed, and you're going to leave this world empty-handed. And therefore, if a person's whole life is simply about or revolves around an accumulation of riches, when he gets old, he's going to find that he was never satisfied because he could never have enough of what he was striving for. He will find that those things that he tried to bring around him never really met his need. He will find when he comes to the moment of death that all those riches could never buy his way out of dying. And then he will find out that ultimately he died empty and unfulfilled and bankrupt. I remember as I was growing up, and occasionally if a very wealthy individual in town passed away, when people would come to the viewing and so on, as they would stand there by the casket and so forth, they would say, you know, I wonder how much he left. And the question that they were asking was really, you know, how many farms outside of town here does he own? Does he really own 1,500 acres of prime farmland? You know, I wonder how many apartment complexes he owns on the other side of town. Does he really own those 100 apartments by himself? I wonder how much stock he has. And of course, their whole thought is, I wonder how much this person was really worth. But in reality, there was a very simple answer to their question. How much did he leave? Because how much was left? Very simple answer. He left everything because he came naked into this world and he left naked from this world. And therefore, a funeral can be that ultimate reminder to me that if I make things the ultimate goal and the ultimate pursuit of life, I'm going to die in a very unfulfilled, empty, and meaningless life. You see, young people, the key to life is not the accumulation of things and to become enamored with things. Too many people, I'm afraid, too many Christians believe that bumper sticker that says, he who dies with the most toys wins. But in reality, you need to change that bumper sticker to read, he who dies with the most toys still dies. Because it doesn't matter how many toys we accumulate at our feet, it doesn't matter how much material stuff we can gather around us, all of that stuff is only mockery in the face of death, because that wasn't what was important anyhow. And that's why, as we said at the very beginning, you've got to look down the corridors of time against the backdrop of eternity. And you've got to learn to look at everything that you see in time against that backdrop and say, is it really worth it in light of death? And then finally, lesson number 7, From chapter 12 in verse 1 is another good one that we can learn, another good lesson we can learn. Chapter 12 in verse 1, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. We'll state it this way, a funeral can remind us that now is the time to turn to God while one still has time, since life passes so quickly. Lesson number 7, now is the time to turn to God while one still has time, because life passes so quickly. Chapter 12 is, of course, a very rich chapter, and it's the culminating chapter in this book where he brings his thoughts on death to their conclusion. And there's a lot of debate as to all of how to interpret a lot of things in verses 2 to 5, so that will have to be left for another time in another place. We won't get off onto that. But notice, if you will, this clear exhortation he gives as he begins this chapter to young people. He says, remember now thy Creator while you are a young person. And of course, you need to remember that in the Old Testament, the word for remember does not just merely recall something, bring some fact back to mind. But to remember means that you're supposed to bring something to mind and learn a lesson from it and then go out and act upon it or change your behavior as a result of what you remembered. And so Solomon is calling upon young people right here, and he's saying, now while you are young in your youth, life passes so quickly. The decisions you make now are going to have such profound effect upon your life. And if you say, I'm young, I have a right to sow my wild oats right now, I'll get things right later, I'll make different choices down the road. He's saying, you're only a fool, you're only mocking yourself, because now while you're young is the time to start setting in cement those vital character traits that you're going to be living out the rest of your life. Because he said, if you don't, the older you get, the easier it's going to be to simply say, it's too hard for me to change now. It's too hard for me to make a correction in midlife. And you're going to go to your grave with all those regrets. I think of Jonathan Edwards, as you know, a very famous American, a very famous thinker. When he was a young man, approximately 20 years of age, when he looked in a mirror and he saw what his life was like, he didn't like what he saw. He realized he needed to make a lot of changes in his life. And as an approximately 20-year-old young man, he penned what today we call his 70 resolutions. Fantastic resolutions. Wouldn't hurt for every one of us to read them and study them and make them our own resolutions. But resolution number 17 that he penned was this: resolve that I will live so as I shall wish I had lived when I come to die. Resolved that I will live so as I shall wish I had lived when I come to die. Young people, one of the greatest sorrows is to talk to people in their twilight years and see only an empty shell of hopelessness that is left. Their physical prowess has now faded. Their physical beauty is a thing of the past. Everything that they gathered around them now mocks them and simply makes fun of them, because there's no way in the world that all of that materialism and all of those things can ever buy back another day of their life. And as you try and talk to them, many times they will say, no, I'm not interested in that anymore. No, I'm going to soon die. I'll just take my chance with what will happen to me. Well, that's the exact thing that Solomon was talking about here in chapter 12 when he said, it's when you're young, you've got to think about eternal verities. It's when you're young, you've got to decide what your life is really going to be like, because the older you get and the more you get set in those things, the harder it's going to be to make a change, a major change, down the road. And thus, a funeral can be far better for us than a party, because when we're sitting at that funeral, we can be challenged and say, what changes do I need to make now in my youth as I prepare for my own death? And finally, lesson number 8, our last lesson, we find in chapter 12, verses 6 and 7. And here, we'll simply phrase it this way: death is final with no second opportunity, and there is an afterlife, so you need to prepare now to meet your Creator. Lesson number 8 we can learn as to why it is better to go to a funeral than to go to a party is because death is final with no second opportunity, and there is going to be an afterlife, so you need to prepare to meet your Creator. In chapter 12 and verse 6, Solomon uses three very graphic phrases or pictures to describe the end of life. He talks about life as being like a golden bowl that is hanging there by a cord. And then somebody comes and they just clip the cord. And when they clip that cord or that string, that golden bowl just falls to the floor. And when it hits the ground, it just shatters into who knows how many pieces. It can't be put back together again. He says that's what our lives are like. It might seem fairly nice. They might seem golden. But someday that cord is going to be clipped and our life is going to be shattered. It's going to be irreversible. We cannot come back. Second illustration he uses is a pitcher that is broken at the fountain. And here he simply is again giving us this picture of a clay pitcher or a jar that is shattered and it cannot be brought back together. And the third picture he gives us is the wheel that is broken at the cistern. Once again, showing us something that is irreversible. The wheel at the cistern is simply broken and you can't glue it together and put it back up and find that it's useful. The book of Ecclesiastes, of course, does not give us what we might call any kind of detailed theology of an afterlife. But notice what he does say in verse 7. He says, then when this happens, the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. In other words, our material parts came from dust originally. It simply is put in the grave and it's going to go back to dust. But our immaterial part is going to live on forever and ever. It's going to return to God. And that's why a person needs to be sure in this life they have made that choice. Where do I want to be when this life is past? And thus we are exhorted here to prepare now for what is going to come very quickly and what will come very unexpectedly and what will come with finality and permanence. Once again, one of the saddest things is to be sitting at the bedside of an individual who is dying and to try and get them to see their need for Jesus Christ. To try and press upon them the claims that this is for real. You're not going to come back from this. If you die, that's it. Your money isn't going to do you any good. Your reputation isn't going to do you any good. Your fame isn't going to do you any good. And yet for many people, it's been too late because they've said no for so often that now in their hardness, they simply reject it again. It's sad to sit at the bedside of a backslidden Christian who's weeping over past sins and lost opportunities and who says, if only I had taken that person's advice when I was younger, if only I hadn't done that thing that I thought would bring me so much joy. I'm reminded of the words of Jim Elliot. Do you remember Jim Elliot, one of the men who was martyred by the Aka Indians in the mid-50s down in South America, who said, when it comes time to die, make sure that all you have to do is die. Pretty profound, isn't it? Make sure, when it comes time to die, make sure that all you have to do is die. That you have lived your life in such a way that you don't have any regrets. So you don't have anything that's nagging you or hanging over your head. And you say, if only, if only, if only. I'd like to conclude our message this morning with a personal story of a death that probably rattled me more than any. And as I said, having come from a funeral home, growing up there, I saw quite a few of them, but when I look back over life, I think probably this death was more had a more profound effect on me than any others. It was late 1960, so most of you were not even born yet. I was in high school in those days. This is a small town in northwestern Ohio. It was a late afternoon on a Saturday, and I was simply out on our driveway. We had a basketball goal, and I was simply out there shooting hoops, just playing some basketball. While I was playing, the town siren went off. In a small town like that, some of you know what I'm talking about. They simply have a big siren that sounds every time there's a major emergency to call the firemen and emergency vehicles and so on. And as I was playing, that emergency siren sounded, and I didn't really think all that much about it because it sounded quite often. Well, probably 10 minutes or so after it sounded, my dad came walking out the door and opened the garage to get out the ambulance. And I said, Dad, where are you going? And he said, just got a call, need to run out here. And so he took the ambulance and left, and I simply stayed, kept playing basketball. It was probably 20, 30 minutes later, he came back, driving into our driveway, backing into the garage. And I saw the cot in the back of the ambulance and that there was a body wrapped in it. And I said, Dad, what happened? Was that part of the siren? He said, yeah, Royce, he said, you'd know the boy who died. And he named the boy by name. And he said he was just at a farm pound just outside the outskirts of town. And he was swimming, beautiful Saturday afternoon. Didn't realize that it was a very shallow pond. And he jumped in head first, hit his head on the bottom, snapped his neck, and he's dead. And he named the boy and he said, so-and-so is now dead. Later that night, as I was alone in my room reading the Bible and praying and having my devotions, as I knelt by my bedside, I just started crying and crying, and I said, oh God, why didn't I care more about that young man? He was a minority, and in a small town in northwestern Ohio, basically everybody is Caucasian, so he stuck out because he was a minority. Didn't talk to all that many people, probably because his English wasn't the greatest. It was fairly broken. Came from a very poor background, living with his mother and living with a half-brother in a very stripped-down apartment over a business district in that downtown area. But I had many opportunities to talk to him because my house was just about 5 blocks from school, and so all through school, I would always walk home at lunchtime to eat. And during those high school years, we would oftentimes walk approximately 2 to 3 blocks together from the high school until we got to his apartment, and he would simply stop off at his apartment and eat lunch, and I would walk another 2.5 blocks to my house to eat lunch. And as we walked, he was a very nice guy, a very moral guy, a very religious guy. But that was probably his problem. He was just too religious. That's what he was banking on. That's what he was trusting in, his religion and all his good works. And as I knelt there at my bed that night and cried, I said, "Oh God, this is it." And I think it was at that time the reality of a life apart from God for eternity struck me as it had never struck me at any time previous to that in my life. Because I realized when a person dies, that is it. There is no second chance. There is no future opportunity. There is no time to say, "Well, I would like to change my decision." And so as we've seen here, young people, a funeral can be a very sobering time. But a funeral can also be a great time because God can use that to teach us some valuable lessons so that we know what's most important right now and so that we can live our lives to the fullest. Even though we're not at a funeral this morning, perhaps there are some lessons here that you need to learn. Maybe there is a young person here this morning who needs to make a radical lifestyle change because you're laying a very unstable foundation for life. And you say, "But I'm young, I've got a lot of vigor, I've got a lot of vitality in me." Within seconds, you could be into eternity. You don't know. You don't know. You need to get your life right, and you need to start making the right kind of choices that will lay the proper foundation. Maybe there is someone here this morning who you would have to say, "You know, Royce, what I am living for is not worth dying for." If somebody came up to me and put a gun to my head and say, "Are you willing to die for what you're living for?" I'd have to say, no, I'm not willing to die what I'm living for. Well, then you've got some radical readjustments you've got to make in your life this morning as well. Or maybe there's somebody here who says, "I need to simply change and begin to see all my decision making against the backdrop of eternity. The contemporary glitz, all these flashing lights around me are so tempting. They draw me into things, and I seem to make so many bad decisions so often." And you need to covenant with God this morning and say, "Oh God, by your help, I want to learn to see everything from now on against the backdrop of eternity so I really do know what's important in time." Or maybe there's even someone here this morning who's not saved. If you died today, you'd pass into a Christless eternity with absolutely no hope. What you need to do is flee to the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ this morning and find that cleansing and that pardon. Because the good news is that death doesn't have to have the final word in our lives. Death is swallowed up in victory because of Jesus Christ's life, because of Jesus Christ's work on the cross, because of his resurrection. And therefore, for those of us who know him as our personal Savior, yes, death becomes an inconvenience, if you will. It creates problems for those who are left behind as they sorrow. But death is simply an entrance way into the very presence of God. Are you ready to meet God face to face today? If your life would be snuffed out before this day is over, are you ready to meet him face to face today? Let's bow our heads for a moment of prayer. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we pray that thou will help us to take to heart some of these weighty things that we've looked at this morning. I pray that thou will help us indeed to realize that even though funerals are not to generally fun occasions, they're not places we like to go, yet they can surely teach us a lot, and there's so much that we need to learn at a time like that. And we'd ask for thy help so that we might learn those lessons, so that we know how to live in time, so that not only do we gain heaven, but we've gained earth as well, and that we can make decisions that will stand in the light of eternity. Oh God, when we look out over an audience like this and we think of all of these lives and we think of how they could be used for thy kingdom, oh God, you know how many times I have personally just cried out and say, "Oh God, if only I had 1,000 lives to live for thee. Spend one life on a certain mission field just translating the Word of God into that language, and then spent another life at an inner city rescue mission, having the joy of seeing people taken from the gutter to the uttermost. And then spent another life in a small town pastorate, and then spent another life somewhere else for Thee. Oh God, but I only have one life. These young people only have one life. But oh, that Thou wouldst get hold of their lives and challenge them to spend that one life profitably in the light of eternity, we pray.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Royce Short, Dean of the School of Religion at BJU. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.